Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guests tonight are MJ Brush. She's an artist and science illustrator, and Alan H. Brush, professor emeritus of physiology and neurobiology, with a broad interest in ornithology and the history of science. And we're talking about their book, Mark Catesby's Legacy, Natural History, Then and Now. MJ and Alan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
How did you come up with this idea for this project?
A long, circuited route of being involved in looking at natural history and looking at old herbals. And then that was when I discovered Catesby.
Go ahead, Alan.
I was familiar with Catesby from his work. There was a work in the by Alan Fiducia on a survey of the pictures of birds and bringing them up to how they're known today. So I knew about the birds.
But what about doing this project where you're sort of essentially following in his footsteps and going to places that he visited? When did you come up with that idea for the project?
Okay, I realize I didn't answer your question fully. Looking at Catesby's work, the realization that he did most of his watercolors 100 years before Audubon. So he had trekked around to the plantations and homes in the area of the Carolinas and Florida wasn't yet a state, but that area, Georgia, and managed to collect for the people back in England, but also brought back his own watercolors. And not a lot was known about him. If you're looking at art history or you working at the Worcester, at the museum, not a lot is known about Catesby until probably about 1975 or so. The Electo Press in England came out with a little traveling show of a lot of his watercolors. That's what we had looked at first. So the idea, the seed planted at that point would be when we retired, wouldn't it be a marvelous thing to go in his footsteps and look at what's happened in 300 years on our East Coast? Because he left such a pictorial view of that. And here we are almost 300 years later, a little more now, and compare and contrast and talk about ecology and talk about the things that Alan wrote about.
Now, we need to talk about a little bit more about Mark Catesby for the audience, because as you mentioned, I think people are familiar with Audubon, or at least have heard the name. But it's amazing how few people know anything about Catesby and why he was important to the natural history of North America.
Correct. So he came to the Carolinas, as they were then called, in the early 1700s. He had actually two visits to North America, one to visit his sister in Virginia, and he did some collecting there and made some contacts. Then he came back at the behest of the Philosophical Society in London. And he was brought in as a collector, mostly botanical stuff, but also to do birds. He was not trained as an artist, but he knew a lot about natural history. He specialized in plants, which he brought a lot of samples back, or sent a lot of samples back. But in the meantime, he did collections. He wandered around in the Carolinas, in Florida. At that time, the border between what was the colonies of England and Florida had a lot more land at the time. He did visit Sloan in Jamaica.
Wow.
And Sloan's collection eventually became part of the British History of Natural History Museum, as the BM, as they refer to it. He went back, but he had some interesting observations about that the birds in the New World were different from some that he knew in the Old World. He did not know that there was not a direct connection between the New World and the Old World. He thought many times, he thought in some cases, that biogeographically they were going to be similar because they didn't understand continental drift.
Mm.
He collected a large number of species, many of which became a part of Linnaeus's first description of birds.
Wow. A lot of people don't realize that that's how natural historians in the Americas finance their trips. They're financed by people who are collecting back in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in many ways, all the way up until now, that's the way it happens. You have somebody backing you to do the research.
That's right.
Yeah. And back to your question about Catesby, he fell between the cracks, in a sense.
He really did.
He was, yeah, the watercolors were bought and stored in Windsor Castle and just laid in a drawer, thankfully, to protect them all those years until they were just discovered by Keurig.
Now, MJ, you did a series. This book is also an art book because it's your paintings of what you saw along the way and almost sort of like an homage to Catesby. I have to say you're a much better artist than Catesby.
I have had a lifetime of training to be an artist. Catesby had none. I was a scientific illustrator for the University of Connecticut for 25 years, so I can draw about anything, but Catesby was mostly, as far as we could tell, self-learned. And the Catesby Society has a marvelous book about him.
That's right.
The Curious Mr. Catesby, if you really want to get the...
I've done an interview on it.
Oh, wonderful. It's just a great book. And then when we met them, it was just a very nice, circuitous route, but it was a nice way to honor Catesby in a way.
Well, one of the things I noticed about your, and I assume these are watercolors from the look of them, aren't
they? Yes, they're all watercolors.
That the layout of several of them really is like an homage. When you look at the crabs and the shrimp, the way that it's laid out on the page is very much like the illustrators that would be doing it in the sort of early 18th century.
But not only the early 18th century, it's still done that way now. Sometimes, the whole publishing era has changed. Now that color is easier to access for people, but that's the way one would lay out a botanical plate or a person, the crabs or the things at the seashore. That's the way you would do it. And that's the way I had always done it and thought it was more in keeping with what he might see and just to kind of carry on that tradition, which I truly love. Some of the old things are precious because they're unique and he may not be the draftsman, but the way he can portray something is just wonderful in his own, his own spirit.
And some of his birds, I think, are very good. His blue jay, I really, really like. Mm-hmm. I think it's really pretty phenomenal. I have to ask you, MJ and Alan, is there going to be a traveling exhibition of this artwork?
Oh, there may be. We haven't done it yet. This was a long term. We had no idea it would take us so long to do the book. But we have thought about that, and I've talked about it, but I have not put it together again. But it may, yes.
There are
prints.
Okay. I would love to see the originals of these watercolors in sort of an exhibition format. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Alan? Go ahead.
Alan, you're on.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say, David Elliott, when the Catesby Center gets settled, is planning to have some kind of an event, a launch, basically.
Well, I hope it turns into a traveling exhibition because it'd be worth seeing these face to face.
Well, that's a compliment.
Yeah. And with large sections from the written portions of this book, which are there's a lot written in this book too. It's not just a collection of paintings. There's a whole comparison of species now and species then. Now, Catesby noticed 109 species of birds,
mm-hmm.
But not one bird species, unlike other artists like Audubon or Buick or Wilson, there's not a bird species that's been named after Catesby.
That's correct. The only animal that is named after Catesby is Rana Catesbyana, which is the laboratory frog.
The bullfrog.
Yeah. The one that you do that you dissect when you're in science class. And there is a plant or two named after him, but not much. One of the things that was striking about the original art is that he put the birds in the proper ecological sense, so that he had, and people were not doing that then. And even Audubon, who's 100 years later, the posture is so very stilted.
Well, it was all about the drama for Audubon.
Yeah, exactly.
And so a lot of the stuff, he's shot these specimens and he puts wires in the body and then he really sells it by over-dramatizing it. Catesby's just trying to get it down on paper is basically
right.
what he's doing.
And so you'll know what we did, that the birds that are extinct, MJ painted from museum skins.
I love that.
Because that's where the only place you can go to see them.
We'll talk about those in just a second. I love the fact that you did that. First of all, that's an honest portrayal of the bird because it is the bird as you saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
go ahead. One of our friends, I must put this in, had an objection of the ivory-billed woodpecker because I put a glass eye in, which wasn't traditional. That's not the way it looked, but no one wants to look at a little cotton ball stuck in its eye, so I put a glass.
With little X's.
Between you and I.
Now, I want to mention, there's a boat involved in this, in your trip, too.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Yeah.
Talk about it. Let's talk about what ship you're using.
Well, the boat that we were on for this is a 33-foot Cape Dory cutter sailboat. The name of the boat is Mokita. And Mokita is a word from a language in New Guinea, which means the truth that everyone knows, but no one speaks.
Whoa.
And that says a lot about our sailing ability, which we tried to keep secret, but we went aground too many times.
Oh.
And it was the third and last sailboat that we owned, and we sold that in 2001 when we came back from this trip.
What a wonderful way to do a project is aboard your own sailing trip. Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
It doesn't get more perfect than this.
I can't tell you about the evenings, how much we love the evenings in the marshes of Georgia when the wrens would be calling and you just anchor in a little cove and it's very quiet all around you and you watch the sun go down.
Oh, man.
Just spend the night.
Okay, stop twisting the knife. Okay.
And you're up at 5 in the morning.
Okay, all right.
You know, out of the cove and then back onto the journey, which was just fabulous.
I need to do a project like this.
Yeah, I agree.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guests tonight are MJ Brush. She's an artist and science illustrator, and Alan H. Brush, professor emeritus of physiology and neurobiology with broad interests in ornithology and the history of science. And we're talking about their book. It's an art book. It's a travelogue. It's a history of ecology and the history of ornithology, all sort of rolled up in one. Mark Catesby's Legacy, Natural History, Then and Now. Alan, I have to ask you, here you are working in physiology and neurobiology. When did you get interested in ornithology?
Well, before I was as a graduate student.
Whoops.
And
were you tempted to maybe give it all up for ornithology?
No, because when I first went to graduate school, I took an ornithology course right off the bat, just out of simple interest. And there was a question that came up that had to do with cedar waxwings. And I knew enough from my earlier training that vertebrates do not digest wax. You know, a kid eats a red crayon, it comes out red crayon. And there are these red waxy tips. So I got interested in bird pigments in mm-hmm. their feathers,
yeah.
their structure, and that led to a series of studies on pigment and how they change, like when a scarlet tanager male molts and then molts into a henny plumage and then molts back again. It's rather spectacular.
Right.
And chemically, it's not very difficult. It's a pretty simple system. But then I got interested in feathers themselves and how they are put together at the protein level and how they evolved. And cut to the end, to the chase, at the end of my academic career, the feathered dinosaurs from China were just
That's right.
Showed up, and I was asked by John Ostrom to go to China to be one of the team that that verified these as feathers. And some of that extended on into our sailing time.
I have to ask you about, because I'm one of those persons that my first word as a child was dinosaur. And I had a passion for paleontology ever since I was like four.
Sure.
But the idea of the feathered dinosaurs is still amazing to me, and still
yeah.
like I can't wrap my head around. I mean, I've seen all the pictures, read all the articles. I know that they exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what a weird idea. I mean, what a weird thing to think of T-Rex maybe possibly covered by these primitive feathers is just strange.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just really wild. Did you, I mean, was that hard for you to?
The fun of dealing with science or illustrating science or writing about it is the curiosity and the weirdness of it all. It's just unexplainable. That's wonderful.
It is wonderful. I mean, it is just amazing to me. But they're also doing some interesting things about pigments in the fossils too, trying to figure out how these birds were patterned and stuff like that.
Yes.
We got to get back to your book. Otherwise, I'll interview you all day about feathered dinosaurs. You mentioned the extinct birds, and let's talk about those next. You did the ivory-billed woodpecker, Bachman's warbler, and the passenger pigeon. Why did you choose those three?
We happen to have good access to them, for one. And Alan, whose undergraduate degree was in the history of science, had a big input of why we chose certain things to talk about systems. Alan, you go on.
Well, one of the things with Bachman's warblers is that they were Cambric specialists. And one of the things that went on during Catesby's time was that they drained the Cambrics to put in rice. And that was part of the situation with why those birds went extinct. The habitat just changed.
He also did paintings of the ivory-billed woodpecker and the passenger pigeon, didn't he?
Yeah.
The passenger pigeon is a beautiful painting by Catesby. And it's always sobering. The whole story of the passenger pigeon is extremely sobering. Here you are dealing with the most abundant bird in North America with these flocks that are miles long.
Right.
And it's now extinct.
Yes, and there were observations all the way along there of with other scientists of the size of the flocks and what happened. And that may have been another combination of habitat destruction. They tended to be to feed in trees and shooting. They were shot commercially. I mean, barrels full would be shipped back from Ohio to New York for as a table food.
It's amazing. And people would just go out for fun and see how many they would throw a stick into these roosting flocks and knock out huge numbers of them.
Yeah.
Ivory-billed woodpecker, there's that controversy.
Oh, yeah.
from a couple of years ago that it might still exist. And I actually did some interviews with people there, and I remain unconvinced that anybody saw an ivory billed woodpecker.
I think you're probably close to the truth.
Meaning, in a very politic way, I am telling the truth.
As a matter of fact, when that all happened and when the article was on the Science cover and John Fitzpatrick from the Cornell Labs was doing that, I sent him a picture of MJ's painting, which had already been done then.
Okay.
And, you know, saying, well, if you really want to know what your chances are of seeing an ivory billed woodpecker, take a look at this. You know, there are three drawers full of them at the American Museum, most of which were all shot on the same day.
Oh, wow.
It's very sad. Very sad.
MJ, I wanted to talk to you about doing paintings of birds like this, that are extinct. Whenever I'm in the presence of a mounted specimen or a skin of a bird that's extinct, there's a definite feeling of solemnity and sadness and the sense of loss that we've, especially when you get to something like the ivory-billed woodpecker, which was our largest woodpecker. There was the woodpecker in Mexico, which was, I think, larger.
The imperial.
But I mean, yeah, I see these and it's deeply saddening to see these birds, but also something very special to be able to touch a skin like that.
It is, and to see how they're preserved. And, you know, as with anything, there's a good and a bad side to it. People wanted to have these specimens for their collections, hence that's why HB was sent over to our colonies to collect. But you can overdo that. And, you know, Audubon did the same thing. HB worked with whatever he had. I worked with whatever I had. But I have to tell you that ivory bill opening up in the American Museum and opening up opening the cabinet first, and the drawers, they're very carefully kept, and seeing them all laid out side by side, you know, would bring tears to your eyes. And then just below the case of the male, with the males, are the females, and I said in the book, they were all the females were collected on the same day, shot and killed on the same day by somebody who is, that's their living, they're making money.
Wow.
By bringing in these specimens to collectors. So that's, you know, the give and take. That's a lot of what the book is about, how we treat the ecology of the earth, what we do with it, what we can do with it, what has been done. I think Alan does a great job of
showing
what we can do for the future.
We were just talking about the rice fields. There's an excellent section in the book about rice and the history of rice in the Carolinas. Bobolinks were considered a pest. And Catesby made those observations, it all ties in together. I mean, there's as many essays on plants in the area, magnolias, catalpas, which I'm fascinated about. When I grew up as a kid in Watertown, Massachusetts, we had several large catalpa trees in the front, and you write an interesting thing about the catalpa sphinx moth and the catalpa tree.
I wish I had illustrated more insects. I illustrated a million for Yukon, and I wish I had more in the book.
But you have this pest of the catalpa tree, but it actually serves a purpose too. The fishermen used to collect them.
Oh yeah, the worms.
Yeah,
the caterpillars. Yeah, there was an industry. Just as an aside about the a little vignette about the ivory-billed woodpecker. They were a specialist in old-growth swampy forests. And one of the last places, one of the last times they were actually studied in the field was in about the early 1940s, and it was a group from Cornell. But that habitat was called the Singer plot. And Singer was Singer Sewing Machines, Chicago, Illinois. But they had this forest because they used the wood to make the cases for the sewing machines.
Oh, wow.
And when they went in, so this is in the book, when they went in there to do sort of the final cut down of things, they used German prisoner of war.
That's right.
were used to, and there's a lot of stuff like that in there, because the habitat has been very much disturbed. But in, early on in the book, I talk about Catesby had a concept about, or at least he described various ecological things that we now understand much better. For example, the change of plant morphology as you go from the south to the north, that there's a bio, there's a geographic change in the morphology. And that was a cool observation. That was done very well. He had an appreciation of what was going on in the world.
Now, you take a trip to the Bahamas.
Yeah.
Again, I want this job. And did you sail to the Bahamas?
No.
Okay, because listening to you describe how many times you grounded your boat, I was going, I hope you didn't sail to the Bahamas. And if you did, you're lucky to be alive. But MJ, you paint a fish, a queen triggerfish, I believe it was, a gray triggerfish.
Yeah, a gray.
And it vocalized.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it did. Yes, it surprised me, just absolutely surprised me to hear that. The things, you know, we have a concept in our mind of how we think things look underwater and what they're doing. But when you actually spend some time snorkeling around and look at them and seeing what they do, they're looking at us as much as we're looking at them for the first thing. And it just had not occurred to me that there would be any purpose in an angelfish making a noise, but they do, out of water. Which isn't, you know, doesn't happen at all in lives of many of them. But there's always some curious little thing that you just don't know unless you look hard at it and you look. And that's what we hope this book does, is have people just walk around and look at what's around you and what you see, and you get an appreciation. And, of course, for an artist, you spend time studying it as well, and you find curious little things that you wouldn't have any other way. And it's a marvelous addition to life.
This is a book also about not just change, but also about loss, not just of species, but of habitat. We're completely out of time, and we could talk about this book for hours. There's a lot in this. There's a lot in this book. Any one essay we could talk about for a half hour, like the essay on rice. My guests tonight have been MJ Brush, artist and science illustrator, and Alan H. Brush, professor emeritus of physiology and neurobiology, with broad interests in ornithology and the history of science. And together, they have produced this beautiful project that's part art, part essays on the history of natural history and also the history of ecology. It's called Mark Catesby's Legacy, Natural History, Then and Now. It's beautiful. Thank you both for being here.
Well, I thank you for having us.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.